Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Corn reaching full maturity by September 1st.
That's USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
National number is almost one-fifth, 19%. That is 6 points ahead of the five-year average of 13%, also ahead of last year's 15%. And looking at the 18 reporting states, almost half of them, eight, are reporting progress that is at least 10 percentage points ahead of the five-year average. Four of those eight states are in the heart of the Corn Belt, led by Missouri, 39% fully mature. Five-year average, just 18%. Other states in the Midwest, more than 10 points ahead of their five-year average maturity rates, include Illinois, 24 versus 11%, Nebraska, 23 versus 13% on average, and Ohio, 14% fully mature, 3% is the five-year average.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The Food and Nutrition Service is really this country's first line of defense for domestic nutrition, about making sure that every American has access to food.
Brandon Lips is co-founder of Caprock Strategies in Washington, D.C., a former administrator for the Food and Nutrition Service.
I'm really proud that the Food and Nutrition Service is part of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. There is obviously a huge nexus between the farmers who produce our food and the Food and Nutrition Service, who helps ensure that all Americans have access to food. Food and Nutrition Service spends about $150 billion a year. As you know, a lot of debate in Farm Bill every year about that level of spending, but it's programs from what's commonly known as food stamps to the school lunch program, senior feeding programs, food distribution program on Indian reservations. So really a whole host of domestic feeding programs that are important to ensuring that all Americans have access to nutrition.
He also says we need to be watching something known as dietary guidelines.
DGAs, we call them here in the Beltway, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Actually, a little known concept that happens also at the Food and Nutrition Service. Congress told USDA, working with their colleagues at the Department of Health and Human Services, that every 5 years, they're to provide nutrition advice for Americans on what they should eat. And that's really what the dietary guidelines process is at its core. It's become very complicated, and we can talk a little bit more about that today. I always say that real nutrition starts on the farm, and if we don't start there, we're going to get all of this wrong, because without farmers, we have no nutrition. But a lot of scientists debate what goes on in making those dietary recommendations, and it makes a huge impact on all Americans, but particularly our nation's farmers.
And how are these guidelines formulated?
Every 5 years, the Departments of Health and Human Services and United States Department of Agriculture put together a committee of scientists who study the latest nutrition science and make recommendations on what Americans can eat. Part of the complication that's entered the dietary guidelines is that nutrition recommendations don't change that much every 5 years. So we've really gotten down in the weeds on what some of those questions are. At its simplest form, USDA's got a program called Start Simple with My Plate, which talks about things that I think many of us agree on. Make half your plates fruits and vegetables, rotate your proteins, make sure you get 3 servings of dairy a day. And I often wonder if maybe we ought to go back to the basics on that. But that's not what happens in this complicated process where scientists meet, make recommendations, and then ultimately the two secretaries take those recommendations and develop them into the dietary guidelines for Americans that are issued every 5 years.
Those are guidelines, but why does this matter to anyone in ag?
If you're a farmer, rancher sitting at home, Tony, I think so many of us back in the day, and some of us still today, say, I don't understand what that is. I don't see how it affects me. At its core, it's public relations on what Americans should eat. So all of us listen to this government commentary on what we should eat, and it can affect changes in purchasing habits. But also, if you think about the $150 billion in nutrition programs that the Food and Nutrition Service has, $20 billion of that is spent on school meals, on school lunch and school breakfast every year. That has to comply with the dietary guidelines for Americans. So if you think about the men or women fixing your local school lunch, they're developing those meals based on the recommendations of the scientific committee and ultimately what the secretaries write in that. And not to be forgotten, our U.S. military, when they're designing meals for our military members, when they're purchasing food for meals that they're serving, that is also controlled by the recommendations in the dietary guidelines. So really a huge impact on purchasing both within and outside of government.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Yeah, they really are looking for that leadership of the issues and policies.
Andy Levine is CEO of the American Seed Trade Association on what rural America wants from D.C.
Farm bill is a key one, obviously, especially for that part of the country. It's so essential to the certainty in what farmers and the agriculture communities in that area do on a daily, weekly, and annual basis. And so farm bill policy is number one, but also looking at some of these other things that has sort of taken a back seat over the last couple of years. We're talking about trade negotiations and trade opportunities in foreign markets. We've seen that starting to dip. We're talking about tariffs. What happens if one of the administrations comes in or another comes in? They both are talking about tariffs, and a number of people said to me, we're worried that one is going to try to out-tariff the other. And so that seems to be a steady stream of thought throughout the Midwest and the Heartland. So those are the kind of things that they look at. The other thing I would add is that, two things that I would add is, one, that continuing regulatory pressure. How do we make sure that we've got some consistency between the federal and state levels and across those state borders, and then also with our markets to the north and to the south? Canada and Mexico are absolutely essential for those two regions, and somewhat tenuous at this point in time with respect to those moving our products or the commodities to those two markets. And then lastly, throughout everybody, is just the uncertainty at the inflation and where is this going with respect to, you know, my grocery bill, my gas that I'm putting in my tanker and my tractor. What are all these things? Where are they going? And how does the government work to calm that down? Whether it's Congress or the White House, they feel that the government is ignoring those issues right now.
But in this regulatory environment, dealing with uncertainty from one administration to another is a big challenge.
I would say it's a bigger challenge today, Tony, than it's been in my time in the association in the government world. And it's difficult. We see a lot of countries around the world where when they change a president or a leader, it swings dramatically. Everybody is gone. And, you know, each time somebody leaves, it's a dramatic swing. And so it's a lot of time re-educating. In the U.S., it used to be just a little bit here in the middle. We're starting to see more of a dramatic swing in the U.S., too, and that's a concern. I think on top of that, that uncertainty of the ongoing expertise of our career employees at, say, USDA or EPA or others, it is a challenge because they've got a lot of years of experience over the time that they've been with the agency or the department. And when you lose that, or there's a threat of being fired by people who don't trust the system, then it really makes it difficult for the industry who is regulated by that group to re-educate, because this is a lot of heavy science, a lot of heavy innovation that unless somebody learned that in college and practiced that recently, they're not up to date on what's going on. So we may not always agree with the decisions that the agencies or the departments make, but they make them based on their expertise and based on the laws that the government passed. And so we would much prefer to have people working in those positions that have experience and want to work with the industry, not people that are put there by politics. So that makes it a little difficult right now to try to get things done and get some synergy with our regulations, with our regulations here in the United States.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
If we look at 2021 and jump back to levels before that, you can see that if I go back to 2003, over that 18-year period, they've nearly tripled in value per acre.
Bob Ray is CEO, Illinois Farm Business, Farm Management on Machinery Values.
We know that two things are arising here. The value of the machinery asset itself is growing, and we have expanding farms, and their investment in machinery is growing as well. The machinery purchases are also increasing per acre. You see, this study was completed through 2021. Our 22 and 23 results are going to be very similar probably to this result in 21 at $67 an acre. And if I take that back to 2016, that's 5 years ago, Those are up, you know, over three times just in that short time frame. But in 18-year period, you can see they're four times as much of an increase per acre. So we know that more purchases are being made and appreciation becomes a lot more critical element to the tax planning business side of farming.
Says there are three depreciation options.
When you make these purchases, there are three types of choices available to affect the tax deduction. The first one, and they go in this order, is the 179 election, the expense election. That's a single dollar amount that you choose to deduct for each purchase item for each selected asset. Then we move to the second option, which is bonus. And in prior years, we've had none of this available. We've had 30% available, 50%. We've had 100% available. And you'll see we're going to add to this slide today, there's an 80% bonus deduction available in 2023. This is more lumpy. It's for a group of assets at a time that you're going to elect to deduct 80% or not deduct 80%. So it's a much more lumpy or wide choice of deductions compared to the 179, which can be elected really on a every dollar increment. The purchases are used as a cash expense, and this could mean that you are using what we call the de minimis rules, such as small materials and supplies. If you're spending under $2,500, then these could land in the cash expense category. Any amount that's not used under the 179 or bonus is going to be placed into our regular maker's depreciation life.
And the most asked question at year end.
This is the time of year where this becomes a really hot topic. Our FPFM staff across the state of Illinois are visiting with farm clients on a daily basis now to talk about year-end planning. And one of the first questions that comes up is this. What should their adjusted gross income be for the year 2023? And to help them analyze that, we think about three things that are not deductible. Those dollars spent for living and your income taxes and any principal payments that exceed your depreciation deduction, the topic of today's study. In my example on the screen, that comes to $130,000 for these non-deductible expenses. So that's one guideline to help us to define where we should land. Now, you might decide that your AGI wants to be lower than that because you want to reduce your tax liability further, and that's okay. We just need to recognize that when that occurs, we are generating income tax deferral, meaning there might be more tax that needs to be paid sometime later. But again, if that's the plan, that's a good plan. Just want to recognize when those things are occurring.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Well, my commitment and passion, and quite frankly, the commitment and passion of a lot of the members of the House Agriculture Committee has not waned a single bit. We know that the timing is urgent, that we get this farm bill done with what our farmers, ranchers, foresters, the key stakeholders of rural America are facing.
The chairman of the House Agriculture Committee from the 15th Congressional District of Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
I mean, I'm real proud of the Farm Food and National Security Act of 2024. It really has received profuse positive feedback from the public and many stakeholders across the country. I mean, the only... I've heard very little criticism from those, quite frankly. And I think that's because we worked hard to bring, to bring Republicans and Democrats, and the voices of rural American and American agriculture to the table. We did, we wrote this bill in a tripartisan way. We wrote it to, this bill would be a real solution. I'm from Pennsylvania, but quite frankly, we wrote this bill for American agriculture, recognizing the similarities and the differences, across the United States. And so, we already extended the 2018 Farm Bill once, and we shouldn't have to do that again if Congress could just do its job. In the House, I'm proud of the Farm Bill that we advanced through our committee. It was a bipartisan bill. Tony, I think as you know, and we've talked about before, there were 40 measures that were legislative measures that were led just by Democrats that I put into this bill. Now, I didn't put it in to get their vote. I'd never do that. I put them in because we vetted those measures, and their proposals helped to put the farm back in the farm bill. 140 measures that were co-led by at least one Republican and one Democrat, and then a whole host of legislative measures were put into the farm bill that were led just by Republicans. This is truly an informed, significant bipartisan bill. You know, the bill really is a product of extensive feedback from the public. That's what made it tripartisan. You know, 40 states, one territory, over 90 different listening sessions that were conducted and held. We're still doing them. Just did a couple in Iowa last week at Farm Progress, and we'll continue to do those. Right up until the moment when we get this bill across out of the Senate and get the president's signature on it. It really is, it's responsive to the needs of farm country. You know, from the start of the reauthorization process, I committed to producing a bipartisan bill informed by the voices of American agriculture outside of the Beltway of Washington. I call that legislating from the outside in, and not just listening to voices inside the Beltway. And I'm proud to follow through, you know, quite frankly, with that commitment. And so I'm still looking for, obviously, to get this to the House floor. There's a lot that needs to be done in addition to the farm bill. We are talking about pre-conferencing, so that's good news with Senator Stabenow and Senator Bozeman, ranking member Scott, and myself and our staff. And so, I mean, there's many different pathways that we can take to get this done. It could be attached to other legislation. We obviously would prefer to do it on its own accord, but I think what's most important is we get the Farm Food and National Security Act of 2024 enacted into law. Everybody benefits, those who produce, those who consume.
Thompson is an Eagle Scout, something he still remembers.
As an old Boy Scout, I've always promised to do my best, and that's what I'm doing.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Well, Asta essentially represents all the companies that produce seed for planting. So you could think alfalfa to zucchini and all production types from organic to conventional to biotechnologies.
Andy Levine is the CEO of the American Seed Trade Association, or ASTA.
We are an association that was founded in 1883. So we like to think about it, if you are eating it on your dinner table this evening, it's started as a seed that a farmer planted years ago, or working in your yard or your garden, that's from seed companies. So we cover the gamut.
That's who ASTA is, but what does ASTA do?
Yeah, our Field Crop Seed Convention is in Orlando, December 10th through the 13th of this year, and it's where we bring together the major row crop seed companies and those involved in providing implements and machinery and other technology around the seed industry. We talk about the issues that impact the industry and what direction we want to go with those issues. We talk about what those policies are and how they'll impact the seed company and their customers, as well as a lot of networking and marketing and new products that are coming into the marketplace. So we bring in about 1,500 people from around the U.S. and 27 countries to really have great conversations and meetings on corn, wheat, soybeans, rice, you name it.
So what's in the crystal ball? In other words, what's the future of the seed industry?
You know, Tony, what we've talked about for a number of years in our discussions back and forth is how we're excited in the seed industry about innovation, especially when we look at plant breeding innovation and new techniques like gene editing. The beauty of where we are with the seed industry and the work that we've done over the last 5 to 7 years to build this up is I think we're really on a precipice of acceptance of new breeding tools as they are developed, and the understanding of the government that they have to do everything that they can to stay ahead or at least catch up to the innovations that are there. There is that realization that we're starting to see that the regulatory community wants to agree with our position and move forward like they did with conventional breeding. And I believe in the next 2 to 5 years, gene editing will be considered conventional breeding, and we're going to be looking at something new on top of that. But it all builds on it. It's really not new. It's just innovative, and it builds on it. It's like a new computer program that's 2.0 or 3.0 or 5.0. This is where we're going with breeding, and it really is going to make a difference as we deal with these issues of global warming or climate change, which, whatever you want to call it, the reduction in tools, crop protection tools, the use of biologicals. All of those start with someone planting a seed. And so the better that we can improve that genetics for the farmer in the future, the better off we're going to be to address those challenges that face that farmer and face the agriculture community. So really excited about where we continue to go with plant breeding innovation. And I think we're really on that precipice where the government is realizing that we could accept this and move forward, and this is how we want to develop policy around it or regulate it. Hopefully it's not too much regulation, but how they want to deal with it.
Andy Levine with the American Seed Trade Association. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
We're going to be coming into tax filing season here pretty soon after the turn of the new year. And this is a case that is a case of first impression, meaning we haven't had another case like this. And now we know what the rule is on this. But let me take you back a little bit on this one.
Washburn University professor and tax law specialist Roger McGowan.
Back in 1985, the U.S. Supreme Court was asked to rule on the issue of whether you could delegate to somebody else the responsibility for filing your tax return. Who is responsible for filing your return? If you hire somebody to prepare your return and then it's not filed, is it their fault or is it your fault? And the Supreme Court put down pretty much a bright line rule, and they said it's your responsibility. You have to make sure that your return got filed. And that was, of course, in 1985. There wasn't anything such as electronic filing tax returns at that time. But now we've got a case involving that same issue with an e-filed tax return.
Are there times with e-filing where that issue could have been avoided?
Well, there is a way to make sure that you don't get into trouble on this, like this fellow did. What happened here was that his CPA that he hired to file his returns, and these are very complex returns with a lot of money that's involved, a lot of tax money, but his CPA failed to file his return for 3 consecutive years. And ultimately, you know, once he finds out he's got a problem, the returns all get filed. But he's got tremendous late penalties, $70,000 in penalties that have accrued over that time period. And he's way beyond the statute of limitations for filing a return. So that's where the penalty comes into play. And the CPA tries to tell the IRS that his tax preparation software couldn't prepare his client's returns because they were too complex. Now, I don't, you know, the court didn't buy that argument. I don't buy that argument either. Even if that were true, get a different tax software, get the returns filed. But he didn't tell the client that the returns had never been filed. And he also didn't update the IRS with the change in the taxpayer's mailing address. So IRS was sending delinquent notices to an old address. It was bouncing back to the IRS. They couldn't find the guy. And so after 3 years of this stuff, IRS finally shows up at his office one day and said, look, pal, you haven't filed returns for 3 years. And that's the first he knew about it. And so this mess blows up at that point in time. Again, this gets into court, and he sues for a refund of taxes. And so we're in court now, and he wants the refund of the $70,000 in tax penalties that he paid. So he paid the assessment by the IRS and sued for a refund. Well, you always want to make sure that your tax preparer is getting things done. And there is a document that you want to have in your hands, and it's very easy for the tax preparer to email that to you. And that's the acceptance notice from the software company that your returns have been successfully electronically filed. And that's really important because of what the court said in this case. They took that 1985 U.S. Supreme Court opinion, which said you can't delegate the responsibility of filing your return to somebody else, and applied that with respect to e-filed returns. So you can't delegate that responsibility to somebody else either. It's your responsibility to make sure your tax returns have been properly filed. And there is that document when a tax return is electronically filed, and it's known as the acceptance notice from the software company, you want to make sure your tax preparer gets you a copy of that so that you know that return has been filed.
Washburn University law professor and tax specialist Roger McCowan. And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We are looking at 94% of the crop setting pods by September 1st, 1 point ahead of the five-year average, equal to last year at this time.
USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey.
And then in terms of soybeans dropping leaves, 13% on September 1st. That is ahead of the five-year average of 10%, equal to last year's 13%. And we have a pretty long list of states, six of them, where the soybean dropping leaves progress is at least 10 percentage points ahead of the five-year average pace. Some of them are in the Mid-South, states like Arkansas, 49% dropping leaves, five-year average just 20%. But that also extends into the southern and eastern Corn Belt. Ohio, again, where the crop's running out of moisture, so it is maturing early at the expense possibly of yield potential. 19% of the soybeans dropping leaves, five-year average, just 4%.